Why don't you bow your heads with me in prayer as we commit this time to the Lord in prayer. Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight. O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Amen. It's a privilege to be with you and to discuss this topic that I think is of particular relevance and importance to us, both as Christians and as citizens of the United States of America. It's been my privilege to join the faculty of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary this fall, and I have very much enjoyed being a part of the community, have felt very, very welcome, and enjoyed getting to know new friends, colleagues on the faculty, and students in the classes. You have challenged me, and that has been tremendous. I have enjoyed it very much, and I thank you. We have much more to look forward to. The opportunity to speak in this chapel service affords me an opportunity, however, to share a little bit with you some of what I have been engaged in and was engaged in before coming to the seminary campus. I've made an interesting and very important transition from the arena of public policy and government to the arena of Christian academics, and for many, many people, that those are completely separate, divergent, unrelated worlds. I want to stand here to say that they ought not to be that way. There ought to be a connection. There should be a connection. We have separation of church and state, and that's very important. But we are also responsible citizens. And public policy is very much a matter of moral judgment, and that we have a place in making our voice known in that process, both as voters and citizens, and if we have the opportunity to participate in that government process as well, if we are in a place where we can do that. I would like to share a little bit of that, both from my experience and from my thinking about this very important topic. The title is The Bible in the Moral War Over Gays in the Military. Few Americans are unaware of the fact that a battle royal has been waged this year and last over the issue of homosexuals in the military. Military personnel policy, a dull subject on the best of days for most American citizens, has in the last year and a half raged as one of the hottest topics of discussion from the halls of Congress to the family living room, from TV talk shows to college campuses, from newsrooms of the media giants to casual conversations with neighbors across the back fence. But while most have heard the claims by which homosexual militants are seeking to persuade the public, theirs is a case of simple justice, and while most also have heard these claims countered by arguments about what it takes to build and maintain effective combat forces, much less has been heard about the conflicting moral views driving each side. Even less is known about how much convictions regarding biblical moral standards have affected the public policy battle. It is my thesis that convictions about what the Bible does or does not teach on the immorality of homosexual behavior and the accountability of persons drawn by homosexual desires have in fact been a major factor in the recent policy war over homosexuals in the military. I come to this partly on the basis of what has been written and partly from direct involvement as a policy player, first as an official at the Pentagon responsible for manpower issues, and then as a strategist who helped shape the public debate and lead the lobbying efforts with Congress. First, I'll address the Bible in the larger social context. It is not my purpose in this lecture to develop a detailed analysis of battles now waging in American society at large, spurred by homosexual militants intent on attacking traditional views on family, gender, and appropriate sexual behavior. I do wish, however, to take brief notice of three battles waged in the larger social context that directly impact the military, and to do so with a view to understanding the stake that biblical teaching either has or might have. These battles are being waged to capture and redirect the public message of three sources of cultural authority: history, science, and the U.S. Congress. Each battle has been initiated by a dedicated army bent on replacing one fundamental morality or worldview with another, an army that will not be satisfied with tolerance but that insists on social legitimacy, public approval, and legal sanctions to guard against moral censure of any kind in the public square. The first of these is a battle to capture history. That is, to redefine the sexual conduct of persons in history and to recast the moral standards of historical leaders. An example from the side of those seeking to change social attitudes on homosexuality is found in an article by Congresswoman Pat Schroeder of Colorado. Published as an opinion piece in Legal Times, Schroeder seeks to portray the Founding Fathers in general, and George Washington in particular, as tolerant of homosexual behavior and unconcerned about its impact on soldiering. She begins by stating, "What was good enough for George Washington is good enough for me," and goes on to discuss the service of Friedrich von Wilhelm von Steuben, a Prussian professional who helped train Washington's inexperienced volunteers. Von Steuben, she claims, without explaining the basis of her assertion, was gay. And it mattered not at all to the men and officers of the Continental Army, including George Washington himself. Unaddressed, of course, is how men, all raised on a more or less strict Protestant sexual ethic, and most of whom were church members, could have had such a cavalier attitude toward homosexual conduct. If she had done a more thorough job of historical research, it surely would have undermined her objective. A more accurate picture of George Washington's views regarding homosexual conduct among his soldiers is found in the following account taken from the writings of General George Washington. At a general court-martial whereof Colonel Tupper was president, 10 March 1778, Lieutenant Enslin of Colonel Malcolm's regiment was tried for attempting to commit sodomy with John Monhort, a soldier. Secondly, for perjury and swearing to false accounts. He was found guilty of the charges exhibited against him, being breaches of the 5th Article, 18th Section of the Articles of War, and we do sentence him to be dismissed from the service with infamy. His Excellency, the Commander-in-Chief, that is George Washington, approves the sentence, and with abhorrence and detestation of such infamous crimes, orders Lieutenant Enslin to be drummed out of camp tomorrow morning by all the drummers and fifers in the army, never to return. The drummers and fifers are to attend on the grand parade at guard mounting for that purpose, end quote. As to the role of scripture in shaping the moral understanding of early American leaders, we need not be in doubt. Although the Bible was not quoted in proof text fashion, it was never far from conscious thought when standards of moral conduct were in view. Washington's judgment that Lieutenant Enslin's homosexual behavior did in fact render him guilty of an infamous crime, deserving of abhorrence and detestation, was consistent with an edict of the Continental Congress issued in 1775 to the effect that commanders of the Continental Army were, quote, strictly required to be very vigilant in inspecting the behavior of all such as are under them and to discountenance and suppress all dissolute, immoral, and disorderly practices, end quote. Noah Webster, who had himself been a soldier in the Continental Army through the Revolution, defined the term immoral according to its usage at the time as, quote, inconsistent with moral rectitude, contrary to the moral or divine law. Every action is immoral which contravenes any divine precept or which is contrary to the duties which men owe each other. The historical evidence taken objectively leads one to two related conclusions. First, the Bible was, for the Founding Fathers, a major determinant of moral standards, and second, their understanding of biblical doctrine on the subject of homosexuality was firm condemnation without exception. A second battle in the larger social context that has direct bearing on military personnel policy is the battle to capture the authority of science pertaining to homosexual desires and conduct. It is now de rigueur in the media and most other institutions of public discourse to presume that, of course, modern science has determined that homosexual behavior is biologically predetermined, irreversible, and though different from heterosexual behavior, is nevertheless equally natural, at least for persons, quote-unquote, born that way. Not only is this perception spread by individuals outside the medical community, it is often encouraged by medical authorities and scientists as well. For example, on March 30th, last year, 1993, Edward Martin, a Clinton administration political appointee, then still awaiting Senate confirmation to be Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, issued an information memorandum for all secretaries of the military department, stating in part, and I quote, homosexuality was once medically defined as an aberrant sexual behavior. However, years of medical, psychological, and sexual research consistently failed to demonstrate the presence of any specific clinical syndrome and or psychosocial profile in practicing homosexuals or either sex. By 1995, the American Psychological Association no longer considered homosexuality an aberrant sexual behavior. In 1976, the American Psychiatric Association enacted the same resolution and removed homosexuality from its diagnostic and statistical manual. He goes on, we are not aware of any scientific evidence that individual sexual preferences in and by themselves, be they homosexual, heterosexual, or bisexual, affect disease incidence, medical costs, or crime rate in the population at large. Homosexuality per se, he says, cannot scientifically be characterized as a medical issue, end quote. In fact, nothing is further from the actual records of scientific research and the history of medical treatments. Nevertheless, bald claims are made in the name of science and backed by the aura of authority granted by position and a medical degree. In fact, the overwhelming weight of scientific evidence favors the longstanding view that homosexuality is aberrant behavior, is largely a matter of social conditioning and acquired taste, and is not an irreversible condition determined by biology, but is, in fact, significantly related to education, family environment, religious beliefs, and culture. As such, it is behavior for which persons can and should be held accountable, and for which they can be treated with success. What transpired as the American Psychiatric Association was being pressured to change its designation of homosexuality and the manner in which a shift in designation was achieved is a very revealing story. In 1973, homosexual activists persuaded members of the Board of Trustees of the American Psychiatric Association, the APA, to remove homosexuality from its list of mental disorder. In its place, they were persuaded to create a new category, which they called sexual orientation disturbance. This, they were told, would satisfy advocates seeking to promote the idea that homosexuality might be a natural sexual variance, but it would not require members of the association to change their medical views on the subject. Thus, the change responded to an intense political campaign and was not based on the discovery of any new scientific evidence. Action was rushed through by a few advocates who circumvented normal channels because the leaders of the field were deemed opposed to the desired alteration. Finally, the manner by which the change passed the APA was not a direct vote on the issue. Rather, wording to change the nomenclature of homosexuality was linked to a statement supporting civil rights, and members were forced to adopt the strategy for change or put themselves on record as against civil rights. Consequently, the APA vote to change the nomenclature of homosexuality was made contrary to the professional judgment of most scientists working in the field, against the position of leaders in the professional study and treatment of homosexuality, and without regard to the medical evidence. We must note the fact that while much energy and expense has gone into the search for a biological cause for homosexuality, scientists have found no evidence yet able to withstand testing. Over the same period of time, the study of gender identity has only added strength to the body of accumulated evidence showing homosexuality to be a learned behavior shaped and strengthened by external factors. The scientific evidence supporting the traditional view is extremely strong, although increasingly ignored, and includes important factors such as the possibility of reversal, the insufficiency of associated biological traits, the power of cultural factors to affect incidence rates, and the inability to maintain favorable genetic indicators through reproduction. At the heart of the battle to capture science, there is a struggle to shift the terms of the larger moral war for arguing the morality of discipline, accountability, and treatment to correct aberrant behavior to the morality of civil rights that ought to protect a normal biological trait from discriminatory prohibitions. Although the Bible is rarely addressed in debating the exploration of new medical hypotheses or the framing of possible conclusions, the import for biblical morality is enormous because there is now such a strong ideological incentive driving researchers to reach conclusions that might be used to shift the terms by which society judges the morality of homosexual behavior. The presuppositions of such medical research often determine claims made at its conclusion. Increasingly, these are raising doubts, at least in popular perception, about how science can be consistent with traditional biblical norms. For example, does the Bible allow a distinction between homosexual status and behavior such that being precedes doing? Does God make homosexuals the way they are? If homosexuality is a natural variant of human sexuality, would it not make sense to allow a responsible venue for such behavior? If these issues are joined and answered in the affirmative, then biblical norms traditionally understood are judged in error or hopelessly out of date. Indeed, we already are well into a battle that seeks to use the aura of politicized science to marginalize, privatize, or demonize biblical morality on homosexual behavior wherever it is found to have had influence in the public square. The third battle in the larger social context bearing on homosexuals and military personnel policy is a cultural battle being waged on the floor and in the halls of Congress. I do not refer here to the general business of political deal-making, constituent representation, and party organization. Rather, I mean to draw attention to a cultural moral aspect that has been injected into the political process in which the Bible and perceptions about its proper interpretation have been used in efforts to capture the moral high ground with congressional colleagues. Indeed, the ramifications of theological and biblical scholarship are here more immediate and direct than in either of the battles already described. Two examples will be given, one from each side of the battle line, but both are generated by the debate over whether to require a change in military personnel policy to accommodate persons inclined toward homosexual behavior. On March 30th, 1993, last year, Gerald Solomon of New York, wishing to show that military policy banning service by homosexuals is not arbitrary, based his argument before the House of Representatives on the fact that the ban is, quote, rooted in our Judeo-Christian heritage. He then argued that lifting the ban would suggest a rejection of those roots and had inserted into the congressional record a theological paper written by John Malloy entitled Homosexuals in the Military, a Moral Issue. The paper was an explicit and traditional review of classic biblical doctrine regarding the immorality of homosexual behavior, starting with the account of God's judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah given in Genesis 18 and 19 and ending with the New Testament indictment against homosexuality recorded in Romans 1. A contrary but equally direct attempt to use biblical authority to sway members of Congress was given by Steve Gunderson of Wisconsin on September of last year. Mr. Gunderson started by explaining that in the realm of morality, quote, a single truth for everyone does not in fact exist, end quote, and that moral issues would be made less difficult if people would only stop thinking their standards of morality had to apply to everyone else. He then addressed the Bible and sought to explain its place in American life and its proper scholarly interpretation, basing his remarks on the work of John Boswell in a book titled Christianity, Social Tolerance, and Homosexuality. The Bible, said Mr. Gunderson, is a living document that evolves with social change. In fact, contrary to the confused beliefs expressed by many of the, quote, sincere constituents who had motivated his speech, the Bible never really condemns homosexuality per se, he said, because there actually is no such word as homosexual in either the Hebrew or Greek languages. I don't think he'd studied the original languages himself. Accordingly, he said, the Bible provides no specific judgment one way or the other on this issue then or now. He ended by saying, we can only take guidance from the Bible's basic message of love and tolerance. Little comment is needed except to point out that both congressmen, despite their very contrary political positions or very contrary policy positions, felt it beneficial to discuss the Bible in order to make a case on the morality of homosexuality before their colleagues and the American people. Each relied heavily on a favored biblical scholar to build his case for the proper morality. I'll move now to behind the scenes at the Pentagon. We have thus far discussed the role of the Bible as it touches three cultural moral battles now taking place in American society at large. Together, these have caused heavy erosion of the moral foundations on which military services have been fixed. Despite the conservative nature of these institutions and the generally conservative moral convictions of professionals who serve in the U.S. Armed Forces, the moral resistance of military leaders to homosexual behavior has been showing signs of stress. What follows will be reflections based largely on personal experiences had as a Pentagon official serving in the Department of the Navy during the last 2 years of the Bush administration and in the transition to the Clinton administration. Prior to the arrival of the Clinton administration with its agenda to radically revise military personnel policy regarding the acceptance and treatment of homosexuals, Department of Defense policy regarding homosexuals was well established and clear. As legal questions began to be raised in civilian courts challenging the military exclusion and discharge policies in the late 1960s and 1970s, the services were made to explain and clearly justify specific limits and procedures used in relation to service members claiming to be homosexual or convicted of homosexual acts. During the Carter administration, the services and the Office of the Secretary of Defense conducted a series of studies responding to a challenge by the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington and produced a well-articulated directive that met and exceeded all requirements for a clear, defensible position in a court of law. That policy, signed into law by President Carter and maintained without change through the present time, states as its basis that, I quote, homosexuality is incompatible with military service. The presence in the military environment of persons who engage in homosexual conduct or who, by their statements, demonstrate a propensity to engage in homosexual conduct seriously impairs the accomplishment of the military mission. The presence of such members adversely affects the ability of the military services to maintain discipline, good order, and morale, to foster mutual trust and confidence among service members, to ensure the integrity of the system of rank and command, to facilitate assignment and worldwide deployment of service members who frequently must live and work under close conditions affording minimal privacy, to recruit and retain members of the military services, to maintain the public acceptability of military service, and to prevent breaches of security, end quote. Although never explicitly stated as such, standing Defense Department policy on homosexual behavior has been based on a moral tradition rooted in the Bible and mediated through the support of the people of the United States as expressed by their elected representatives in Congress. The morality that gave definition to the disciplinary standards of the Continental Army have continued in place, and although definitions and procedures have been made more precise, the fundamental moral framework has continued without alteration, that is, until recently. Starting a few years ago and beginning well before Clinton was elected to office, cracks began to show in the level of confidence military leaders had in maintaining convictions about the immorality of homosexual conduct and the accountability of persons inclined to engage in homosexual acts. Recruitment policy under the Bush administration. In February 1991, when I arrived at the Pentagon as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower, I found that serious questions were being asked regarding the recruitment policies of the various military services. Recruitment has to do with a requirement that persons awarded publicly funded military scholarships in exchange for a commitment to serve must reimburse the government for the used portion of their scholarship if they quit their program of study or voluntarily become disqualified for military service. Despite the fact that the issue was one that pertained directly to my appointed responsibilities, information was so closely guarded by my immediate superior, Barbara Pope, Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Manpower and Reserve Affairs, that I would have known nothing at all if I had not probed her staff and embarrassed them into giving me relevant materials. I discovered a review was well underway and was nearing completion that was heading toward changing the way recruitment policy would be applied to students who became disqualified for military service on announcing a discovery of homosexual identity. It must be remembered this was well before the rise of the Clinton administration and any discussion of changing acquisition policy pertaining to homosexual identity. The standing policy treated such cases as a matter of personal responsibility and volition. Candidates for scholarships have always been and continue to be screened for service eligibility. At that time, they were required to answer direct questions on whether they considered themselves homosexual or bisexual, defined to include sexual behavior for a person, a sexual desire for a person of one's own sex, and whether they intended to engage in homosexual acts. Affirmative answers meant automatic disqualification. The review, I discovered, did not pertain to students who had known they were homosexual on accepting a military scholarship. Such cases fell into the category of fraudulent enlistment, a category which automatically warrants disciplinary discharge with recoupment of scholarship benefits fraudulently received. Rather, the review was undertaken pertaining to students who purported honest enlistment as heterosexuals, but later announced a discovery of their hitherto unknown homosexual identity. Should the Defense Department policy on recoupment continue to treat the disqualification of such cases as something over which the individuals concerned have control, or for which they can and should be held, accountable, or should the disqualification be treated as something over which individuals have no responsibility and no control, and for which they cannot be held accountable? The policy review was launched because the Navy was facing the prospect of multiple court challenges to the standing policy, including at least three recent graduates of the United States Naval Academy, who had been awarded commissions and sent to the fleet before announcing their quote-unquote discovery of homosexual identity. Lengthy challenges in court fueled by the growing militancy of homosexual activists was clearly anticipated. Despite our well-settled policy on the exclusion of homosexuals, this aspect turned on judgments regarding the nature of homosexuality, and perceptions were changing. Vice Admiral Borda, then Chief of Naval Personnel, and by the way, most likely to be tapped to be the next Chief of Naval Operations, was feeling the pressure and felt unsure about how defensible the existing policy would be if challenged in court. As a result, he had begun a push to have it changed. Barbara Pope was put in charge of reviewing the policy and recommending an appropriate response to Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney that would then be implemented consistently across all the military services. When I discovered the review, I found no effort at all had been made to defend, much less strengthen, the existing policy against possible challenge. Rather, there was going to be a single recommendation with pragmatic justifications, all based on accepting as legitimate the basic premises of the homosexual activists, that homosexuality is determined by biology, that biologically based conditions are irreversible, that no matter how late in life a person discovers, quote unquote, his or her homosexuality, it is still a matter determined by their biology. So becoming homosexual is not a choice for which individuals can be held responsible, even if they reach full adult maturity, all the time thinking themselves heterosexual. Having come directly from working domestic policy at the White House for President Bush, I was very aware of his strong traditional values on the subject, and it greatly concerned me to find an effort underway that appeared headed in a direction that would be directly contrary to the personal convictions as well as political commitments of the president. To address the matter and hopefully head it back in a more responsible direction, I wrote a memorandum to Barbara Pope explaining the moral and ideological conflict surrounding the challenge to military policy, discussing the scientific record, reviewing the political stakes for the president, and recommending that we keep the existing policy. What I received in return was a compliment on good writing style and a dressing down for spending valuable professional time doing my own analysis of the issue. Needless to say, my analysis and recommendations were ignored and rejected. The review went forward with no dissent, and the recoupment policy for homosexuals was changed with the approval of Secretary Cheney. I found out later that Barbara Pope had already preset the policy direction with David Addington, Special Assistant to Secretary Cheney. It was all highly controlled and secret. The president was never involved, even though the policy change was completely inconsistent with his values and political commitments. Consistency with the president concerned me very deeply. But what concerned me most of all was the failure of key policymakers, political appointees, who were given their authority by President Bush to express appreciation, much less concern, for the moral stakes involved as viewed from the moral tradition on which the pre-existing policy had been framed. There seemed to be a total lack of awareness that changing presumptions to accept the legitimacy of homosexual claims would actually entail rejection of a morality that not only happens to be consistent with the Bible, but is the moral tradition held once by the Founding Fathers, held then by President Bush, held still by most men and women in uniform, and yes, held still by the overwhelming majority of the American people. But in fact, a different moral perspective was already operative and evident in the value judgments and policy directions provided by the individuals who were given control of the policy process, Barbara Pope and David Addington. They were the key political players whom Cheney put in charge and trusted to set a proper course, and it was clear from Barbara's response to my analysis and recommendations that she saw no legitimacy whatsoever in the traditional moral perspective on which it was based. It was not her own, and she had an ally in Cheney's office who could see it through. Consistency with the president, with the majority of the American people, with most of the men and women in uniform, with the founding fathers, and with objective science did not matter in the end. She was convinced she knew the right thing to do, and she knew how she was going to get it done. The problem was she had already adopted a new moral perspective, a perspective that accepted the legitimacy of homosexuality and that judged it immoral to hold anyone accountable for becoming involved in homosexual behavior, even though they had never thought of themselves as homosexual before they entered the military service. The war goes hot with the Clinton transition. For their part, most of the senior military leadership just did not realize the moral stakes. The differences seemed small, pragmatic, and essentially political. It was not until the shock of Clinton's election and his commitment to lifting the military ban on homosexual service that the military leadership really woke up to the danger of applying homosexual presuppositions and arguments to the military situation. When it did, their resistance to the proposed changes was both moral and practical. And as their moral convictions were stirred, so was their interest in the biblical origins of the traditional moral perspective on which they continued to operate. In the transition period between Clinton's election and the end of the Bush administration, a Navy chaplain serving the Marine Corps, Commander Eugene Gomulka, produced a paper sharply attacking the pressure to change longstanding policy, excluding homosexuals from military service. His analysis was eagerly copied and distributed through senior military circles, and not because he was considered to be an expert on military personnel policy per se, but because his views commanded moral respect, respect for the traditional side in the moral war that could no longer be ignored by people in uniform. Also during this time, an outline of what the Bible teaches on homosexuality was distributed and eagerly copied and even made it into some official briefing books prepared for senior military officers needing to become more knowledgeable on what suddenly had become the hottest concern in the building. I know that because I prepared that outline. When the need for moral foundations became urgent, biblical teaching on the issue suddenly became important. Not for all, certainly, but for many. And although the demand for biblically based instruction could never be official, it was nevertheless felt and accepted on an individual level, and that in turn steeled convictions that could be expressed in practical, social, and military terms. I'd like to talk now about some strategic areas for theologians and biblical scholars addressing this issue. Americans live in a country where biblical teaching, or at least perceptions about biblical teaching, still can be a major influence on the moral judgments of public policy decision makers, depending on what sort of issue is involved. Homosexuality, because of its radical departure from majority behavior and its obvious threat to foundations necessary for sustaining the nuclear family, is one of those issues. Because it is, failure by theologians and biblical scholars to speak clearly and with relevance in support of classical biblical norms leaves listening public policy decision makers without sufficient backbone to face the onslaught of new and contrary claims demanding removal or reversal of policies derived from a biblically consistent moral perspective. On the other hand, the converse is also true, for the opportunity is there that clear teaching by theologians and biblical scholars can yet have strategic influence on public policy decisions as pertaining to persons promoting homosexual desires and conduct. Their influence is not and has never been direct, but many decision makers are listening, desirous of supporting true morality and loath to weaken standards on which they were raised. For such, the assurance of confident biblical scholars conversant with the battles of the public policy moral war as well as with scriptural is all that is required to settle their convictions and stiffen their resistance. But what areas of biblical scholarship promise to be most strategic in the public policy moral war engendered by the advance of homosexual militants bent on shaping public perception, public values, and public law enforcement to a new morality contrary to biblical morality? On what aspects of the policy debate concerning ethical treatment of homosexuals should theologians be focusing their attention? Given the points at which existing policy is coming under attack, I believe biblical scholars and theologians must offer strategic commentary in three key areas. The progressive and morally corrosive spread of homosexual conduct through culture and society. That's the first. The nature of homosexuality and attendant issues thereto. That's the second. And finally, the progression involved and consequences following from shifting moral paradigms. Let's review these. The first key area on which biblical scholars must concentrate has to do with the manner in which homosexual behavior will grow and spread through a culture that ceases to resist it, then comes to tolerate it, and finally arrives at celebrating homosexuals and protecting their behavior. There is much to be gleaned and learned on this subject from a careful analysis of the two Old Testament accounts in which whole communities were overcome by militant, celebratory homosexual behavior. The first regards the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and is recorded in Genesis 18 and 19. The second regards Gibeah of Benjamin and is recorded in Judges 19 and 20. We should consider, for example, the rather sobering claim made in Genesis 19:4 that the crowd of militant males demanding homosexual sex with Lot's visitors were, in fact, quote, all the men of Sodom. Lest we take this all-inclusive statement too lightly, the passage underscores what all the men really means by adding from every part of the city and both young and old. Apparently, all is indeed meant to be all in the sense of geographic distribution as well as all across the spectrum of possible ages. What does this imply? It would appear that once all moral and cultural restraints are broken down, social pressures throughout a community will reverse. Culture and social pressure turn from barriers restraining homosexual expression and become forces in its favor, promoting its spread until it may even reach 100% or virtually 100% of the local population. If this historical account is true, it has serious implications for those who currently find comfort and safety in scientific studies showing a low incidence rate for homosexuals in American culture. Present figures may not be anything to rely on if they are only measuring the early stages of a progressive social cancer. While cultural tolerance of a fixed and tiny minority may seem magnanimous, acceptance and promotion of a malignant cancer will assure moral and cultural death. The second key area which biblical scholars and theologians must address has to do with issues surrounding the nature of homosexuality. A struggle is now taking place in the courts, in Congress, in the departments of the executive branch of government, and in our schools over whether homosexual status can be distinguished from homosexual behavior, or whether they are indistinguishable because homosexuality is a status that's defined by behavior. Which is true? Does the Bible speak to this issue? Is homosexuality first something that one is before it becomes something one does? Or is it something one becomes because of something one does? Here the battle to capture science must be followed and engaged by non-scientists who nevertheless are knowledgeable enough about science to discern good science from bad, and to discern politicized science talk from tested and repeatable findings of scientific fact. The theological and moral implications of new claims made concerning the nature of homosexuality are indeed enormous. Does the Bible account of creation allow for variations of human sexuality other than male and female? I refer you to the verse quoted in the program. Can the institution of human sexual relationship following from the creation of Eve and her introduction to Adam be legitimately stretched to allow sexual knowledge of men with men and women with women? Does the institution of marriage that follows the creation of Eve for Adam, include the blessing of same-sex marriages? If homosexuality is a biological status before it is expressed in behavior, does that make God responsible for creating homosexuals? And if so, how can it be immoral for persons to behave according to the way they were created? Biblical scholars and theologians who take the Bible seriously simply cannot ignore such questions, for biblical interpretation is already being stretched and revised to arrive at just such conclusions. In addressing the nature of homosexuality from a biblical foundation, theologians must not only develop teaching taken from the creation account in Genesis, but must also study the statement of the Creator in Leviticus, who in dictating the law to Moses not only rules against all homosexual behavior, but goes on to say that those caught deserve punishment and have no one to blame but themselves. Quote, their blood will be on their own head, Leviticus 20, verse 13. This is the Creator himself, stating in audible words heard and recorded by Moses that homosexuals, without exception of any kind, cannot shift blame or moral accountability for their behavior to the Creator. Can biblical scholars take the Bible seriously and still find room here to support cultural moral trends that wish to recognize a status that might make homosexual conduct moral, or that makes homosexuality a divine creation for which individuals should not be fully responsible? To this must be added the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 6:11, in which he uses the term homosexuals, in the Greek arsenikoitai, to characterize something that some of his readers had been, but no longer were. The verb tenses here are clear and precise and would rule out anything like an irreversible biological condition. The final key area in which biblical scholars must concentrate if they are to respond strategically to the moral war in public policy over the treatment of homosexuals has to do with helping policymakers understand the progression involved in shifting moral paradigms and the way it relates to the acceptance and practice of homosexuality in both individual as well as cultural levels. A time has come when special attention must be given to the progression listed in Romans 1:18-32, for it reveals much about the manner in which moral paradigms are shifted, as well as what follows once the shift of moral paradigms has taken place. What begins with failure to be thankful for what God has given moves to adopting a false moral compass and the rejection of true moral light based on God's self-revelation, continues through successive stages to an eventual embrace and celebration of aggressive homosexual behavior, and ends with the active efforts to recruit others into acceptance of homosexual morality and participation in the homosexual lifestyle. Again, there are lessons here that are immediately relevant to current public policy battles. Responsibly engaged biblical scholars and theologians must work out and apply insights from Romans 1 and apply them in ways relevant to decision makers caught up in the public policy moral war. Work of this sort will be strategic and could be determinative if disseminated before public policy decision makers are wholly overcome by the mounting chorus of new voices who simply presume the legitimacy of the new homosexual morality and press policymakers to respond to demands that only make sense if the new moral paradigm is accepted and the old one set aside as irrelevant. In the end, it will be these battles and their outcome in favor of one side or the other that will determine the final direction of the specific policy issues, such as military personnel policy touching on persons who engage in or who are attracted by homosexual behavior. Because these battles are shaped at the level of competing moral paradigms, the Bible and its interpretation has and will continue to play a strategic role in affecting the moral convictions and judgments of policymakers. Theologians and biblical scholars who take the inspiration and historicity of the Bible seriously must not ignore the impact their work can have on the treatment of moral issues in public policy, and they must not fail to address the moral stakes involved in matters such as the rejection of homosexuality by the military services. Their impact will be felt one way or the other. Let it be the impact of strategic and intelligent engagement and not the impact of ignorance and neglect. Thank you very much.